Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Bhumika, the host for our interview today. And today we are going to be speaking with Professor Adeline M. Masculier, who is a professor of anthropology at Tulane University. Adeline has done extensive ethnographic research and writing in Niger on various subjects, on matters of religious conduct and identity, practices, on marriage, love and romance, on healing, and one of my favorites, on social memory and road mythographies. Today, we will be speaking to Adeline about her new book, her latest, Fada, Boredom and Belonging in Niger, which was published this year in 2019 by the University of Chicago Press. Adeline, welcome to the show. We're so happy and excited to have you. And I was wondering if we could begin this interview by you telling us a little bit about your own journey in anthropology, about the, you know, your arrival to anthropology and the various choices that you've made through your career in matters of research, methodologies, and the way you've gone about it so far.
Gladly. So I came to anthropology a bit circuitously. I was born and raised in France, and upon graduating from high school, decided I wanted to spend a gap year in the U.S. to learn English properly. And so I made my way to North Carolina and spent a year there. Luckily, I applied to university, and when I was admitted to UNC Chapel Hill, I ended up placing as a junior, which I thought at the time would be a great advantage. And I eventually convinced my parents to let me stay an extra year so I could graduate with a bachelor's. But that left me very little time to think about what I wanted to major in. And of course, the question of major, the question of how one goes about making decisions and structuring one's life as a college student, all of that was very foreign to me. And I was a 17, 18-year-old who barely spoke English. In any event, I ended up majoring, oddly enough, in zoology. Somebody decided for me, actually, and I never changed the major, but I was really doing biology. I wanted to be a doctor at the time. I thought I wanted to do medical research. So I spent 2 years taking a lot of biology and courses having to do with genetics, cell biology, and so on and so forth. But of course, I also had to take a few other courses to satisfy other requirements. So I took an anthropology course, and I really liked it. So I took another. And then another. Eventually, I graduated, as I said, after 2 years, a bit rushed, but having learned English properly, as well as a little bit of science, of course, went back home really didn't know what I wanted to do, attended university in France, spent a year in Spain, taking more anthropology courses, and then eventually decided, well, I don't want to do medicine. I want to do anthropology. So I came back to the US, ended up doing an MA in Illinois, and then went on to the University of Chicago to start my PhD. So that was, you know, a bunch of, I mean, I really, but I feel like I didn't decide some of that. It was just sort of circumstances. At the University of Chicago, I met Jean Komaroff, I wanted to work with her, so I decided I had to work in Africa. Niger, I had been there as a child, as a teenager with my parents on a short touristy trip. And I thought it would be great to go back. I had really had a wonderful experience there for 10 days. So I decided this is where I want to, you know, do my field work. Of course, I was interested in religion, ritual, and I still wanted to somehow connect to my interest in medicine and healing. So I decided spirit possession would be a good topic, a good issue to research. It would sort of bring together my interest in religion and my interest in medicine. And Hausa was a language that you could learn at Northwestern University, which was, of course, right around the corner from the University of Chicago. So I decided to work in the Hausa-speaking region of Niger. Hausa is a lingua franca, which means that you can conduct fieldwork in a variety of places. It affords you great mobility, great freedom when it comes to choosing a field site. So that's how I came to the small provincial town of Dogondutchi, a few kilometers from the Nigerian border. So that's where I ended up, conducting field work for my doctoral dissertation on spirit possession. And I returned there many times over the past 31 years ended up picking up along the way other interests. I was, of course, interested in, well, of course, I picked up an interest in gender, wanted to work with women, decided the resurgence of a certain kind of Islamic piety was quite interesting, and I wanted to look at women's investment in the Islamic revival movement. So my second book focuses on that issue. And youth, which is, of course, the topic of the current book we're discussing, wasn't originally something I wanted to explore. But at the same time, Niger happens to be, amongst other things, the poorest country on the planet, or so the United Nations Human Index Development tells us. It's regularly ranked at the very bottom of the Human Index Development Scale. It also has the highest fertility rates, and it is the youngest country on the planet. Something like 75% of the population is under 25. So you have lots and lots of children, lots of youth everywhere. It's something that always strikes tourists and foreigners when they arrive. The number of children, the number of youth that that you encounter as you walk in the street, as you sit in public spaces. So at the time when I was thinking about a new project, I thought it might be interesting to look at the situation of youth, and especially in the current economic context, where many of them, young men in particular, cannot find jobs because there simply isn't a market for the cohorts of young men who are emerging every year out of high school and university. So those who have who are educated, who actually have invested in education, thinking they're going to get a job, are very disappointed. Meanwhile, those who have not attended school also have to struggle in the informal economy. So all of this was very visible to me, and I ended up, you know, sitting at with them in the street. They were all drinking tea, chatting with one another, and so initially I was just looking at youth as a potential problem to investigate, but I wasn't actually sure what my specific, you know, issue with them would be, what exactly I wanted to write a book about. I was initially drawn to their interests and engagement with Islam, since Islam and Muslim practices had been the topic of my second book. I thought this was a sort of logical extension of that project. And then the more I learned about the fada, those tea circles, those informal conversation groups that young men have created, the more I realized this wasn't just the setting of the book. This was also perhaps the subject of the research, and so that's how I came to write a book about those particular practices of sociability.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic! Thank you so much. This provides me the perfect opportunity to ask you the sort of the other question I had in mind about the book itself, about Fada, and I wanted you to tell our listeners about the space of the Fada itself, which is pretty much, you know, the substance, the premise, the methodology of the book. It runs through the book like a lived experience. And so if you could tell us about the term itself, what it means, its history in sort of the urban public spaces that you are situating it in, and what is it about the possibilities of the Fada itself that excited you or sort of drew you to a book-length project about something which may otherwise seem as quite ordinary as sort of, you know, drinking tea, being bored, and socializing with men of your age. So if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the Fada itself as a category and as a unit of both lived experience and space as well.
Yes. So Fada is the Hausa term for the elders' council, the chief's court, the emir's court. So it is the seat of government, the traditional seat of government at the village level, at the town level, as well as in the more more expensive districts that are run by or that are headed by emirs or chiefs or kings. And so it's, of course, essentially a male space, right? It is the council is made up of male elders. Women would only be entering that space if they had some request to make, or if they had a grievance to lodge against a neighbor or a family member and wanted to be heard in court. If we want to sort of go back a few years to the early 1990s, at the time when the economic reforms that were mandated by external donors, the World Bank, the IMF, and other partners, international partners funding Niger, all those different parties requested that Niger, in order to renew loans and be afforded financial assistance, Niger had to make some very drastic changes, cut social services, and basically retract the public space, the public sphere, public services. What that meant was that education, healthcare, and other publicly funded administrative services were seriously reduced, and unemployment really just everyone, no one could find, you know, the young men could not find jobs anymore. There was really an explosion of unemployed young men around. As well, because one of the issues was the defunding of the university and the school system, students both at the high school and at the university level went on strike, and they were all sitting in the street. Students, especially in Niamey, the capital of Niger, were sitting in the street with very little to do. They took to drinking tea, which was not a typical occupation of any young people. Tea was thought to be something that Tamashek-speaking people, Tuareg people engaged in. Civil servants as well occasionally drank tea in the afternoon during a break or after work. But it wasn't something that was very widespread, certainly. And so there was this new form of sociality that just emerged. All these young mm-hmm. people sitting in the streets with little to do. They had no place to go. They didn't want to sit in the family compound, which is typically thought of as a more female-oriented space. They did not participate in their elders' occupations or were not part of those social spaces either. So informally, those conversation groups started coalescing. And of course, there was a political dimension to these spaces, because young people, the student movement, especially the student association, was directly implicated in the general strike that ended up happening in 1990, and eventually all of this resulted in a national conference that completely revised the whole way that government was imagined for Niger. I mean, basically, it was the path to democracy. This really opened a democratic space, and elections were held for the first time, democratically held elections, and Nigerians went to vote for the for deputies in the assembly, for a president. I mean, suddenly they had, everyone had a voice in the choice of government they wanted to have. So this was a very exciting time. And so young people, despite being economically disenfranchised, were very much participated in this process. The other side to the FADA, to those informal conversation groups, was that because Niger was opening up to the rest of the world through radio, through television, through finally a free press, where you know newspapers could be produced that didn't have to just parrot what the government, which at the time, of course, was not a democratically elected government. All these sort of opening up to the world enabled young people to also participate through engagement with social media. So the FADA coalesced around private radios that emerged in various towns in Niger. So the FADA as a youth project was very much an urban project. This mm-hmm. happened in Niamey, in Dogondouchi, in Maradi, in a variety of towns, but it was very much an urban project. Young people, young men could become members. They could buy cards so that they could participate in radio shows where they would have conversations with the radio host who would read their names, and they would be able to greet each other. So it was a way to create visibility for young mm-hmm. people, to hear your name spoken on the radio, to hear the radio host, you know, speak your name and greet the FADA and enter in conversation with different young people who could voice their opinions about a variety of topics. This was extraordinary. This was unprecedented. This gave them a kind of a place to inhabit, right? Which they did not previously have in a society that's very hierarchically or structured, where youth don't have much power, don't have much voice. Mm-hmm. And so this was also the emergence of those private radios was very important to the creation of the FADA. Each FADA, which was typically composed of anywhere between 6 to 20 or 25 or 30 youth, each of them had a boombox. This was the primary, if you want, form of infrastructure of the FADA. You could sit anywhere against a wall. All you needed was a bunch of mats or a bench, perhaps a few chairs. But the important investment was the boombox, so that you could play music, you could listen to your favorite radio shows, and you could hear your name be spoken by a radio host, and know that other youth would hear it, and that created a sort of community of youth who spoke to each other, through the medium of the radio. And of course, some of those radio shows, as I said, were specifically tailored to young audiences. They spoke about love, unemployment, how to dress. A lot of young men became enamored of hip hop. So the radio was essential to the emergence and the consolidation of the FADA as a kind of social infrastructure. Eventually, if you by the millennium, at the turn of the millennium, If you were a young man, age 14, 15, 17, 20, and you didn't belong to a fada, you were really an outsider.
Thanks, Adeline. You know, it's very interesting that you talked about the kinds of perhaps new socialities that the fada is generating at these sites. And, you know, in your third chapter, chapter on the gender relations of the fada, the kinds of experiences that it generates for differently gendered groups and identities, I was very struck by a reference that you make to the new ways in which love and romance is being perhaps imagined. You know, you say that this is money is the new currency for love, and that people are now marrying for love. And it's interesting to notice how mostly heterosexual love is being imagined in these sites of intense homosociality. So I was wondering if you could offer our listeners some comments on what did you see and what did you notice in terms of these radio broadcasts, in terms of these new ideas about music and romance and love that may or may not have new possibilities for imagining you know, restructuring of kinship or marriage, or are they in some sense reproducing the kinds of patriarchal or masculinist hierarchies, or are they producing new kinds of masculinities? Is there a romantic man to displace the domestic man? So if you could tell us a little more about the kinds of possibilities that something like marrying for love or, you know, in a cash economy, the possibilities of romance and love provide for these young men and women engaging at the fada.
Yes. So Niger and Hausa society and other in many of the various regions of Niger, perhaps it's not totally evenly the same across the country. Tuareg people have sometimes distinct ways of apprehending marriage and gendered division of labor. Tuareg people were traditionally pastoralists, and women have a different role to play. So I'm not excluding them, of course, because many of them have been urbanized, and most of them don't engage in pastoralist practices anymore. The cattle has died. You know, the environmental conditions and the war, the two sort of moments of civil strife that occurred in the mid 1990s and early on in the millennium have made it very difficult for some pastoralist groups to keep engaging in you know, raising sheep, cattle, camels, and so on. But in any event, so it's true that romantic love has become a new mode of imagining domesticity, marriage, initiating a family. Traditionally, marriages were arranged. That's, of course, not specific to Niger. But the idea, of course, was that the stuff of marriage and the idea of two people bringing two families together through marriage was such an important matter that it couldn't be left to young people. Elders had to participate in the process. And gender segregation is very much part of people's lives still today, which means that women, wives, wouldn't have to spend much time with their husbands, who were mostly outside the home, whereas women were typically spending much of their time in their homes. Some of them would be, in fact, secluded. This had much to do with Islamic, a degree of religious commitment, right? If you wanted to demonstrate you were a profoundly pious man, you would seclude your wife or wives. That meant that you had also a certain amount of wealth, because you had to employ domestic servants to carry out the work that women wouldn't do because they couldn't leave the home. This is still happening in certain either elite Muslim families or pious families, where men want to demonstrate their faith by secluding their wives. The opening up of Niger to a variety of external cultural influences, with the political transition to democracy, also brought to Niger new modes of imagining marriage. And one prevalent medium was the telenovela. I started noticing that families, young people, but also parents, youth, elders, everyone was watching television, including Mexican and Brazilian telenovelas. And these were essentially about romantic love. And love was a big drama. And young people really, young girls and women especially, but young men as well, started watching certain telenovelas, and they would run perhaps twice or three times or four times a week. And everyone was watching, and people, young men told me they would organize their entire schedule so as to not miss the time when the telenovela would you know, their favorite show would be on. And of course, inevitably, you'd have power cuts. And so that was absolutely dramatic, because everyone would rush to the household where they knew there was a generator, and the TV would still be on. And a friend told me once that his brother had a generator, and all the young men, everyone converged to his brother's house, and this house that could, I mean, reasonably only hold about maybe 25 people all bunched up together on the floor and on the sofa, was filled with about 100 people, and they were coming out of the windows, and everybody was looking in, and some of them were on the roof. I mean, it was just this madness. So all this to say that the telenovela, the you know, romantic love became something really important. Young men would tell me that they identified with certain characters in the shows, and there was a kind of something in the air about romance, about love and marrying for love. And young men started telling their parents that they would not want to have arranged marriages. This, of course, didn't happen suddenly. This has been going on for a while. But the emergence of those shows really sort of created a context for young people to start asking themselves what it is they wanted in a marriage partner. What's interesting, and I'm trying to respond to your question here, is that courtship, therefore, is a lengthy process during which young men court young women in a way that they they're competing with one another, and young women are expected to listen coyly to their paramours' messages, their poems, their love letters. Now, of course, they don't write letters anymore. They just use text messages, and they can download entire poems from the internet to prove their love. They don't even have to learn to know how to speak love and to be poets, as once was required of them. So courtship is a time of imagining, is a time of promise, is a time of a very fertile space for imagining what a presumably prosperous middle class marriage life would be like. And this is where the young man has to prove himself by showering the young woman with gifts. And if he can't do that, well, he doesn't stand a chance to win his girlfriend's heart, because presumably others will do that before him by buying her a refrigerator or a fan, or giving her lots of cloth and paying her tailor's bill. So there is a kind of friction between materiality and the supposed disinterestedness of romantic love. Of course, it's more complicated than that. Transactions have always been part of marriages, are essential to the strength of marriages. And there are still arranged marriages today. There are still young girls who are forced to marry men whom sometimes they've never met before, maybe considerably older than they. Much of it has to do with the way in which elder men have access to wealth that they can use to contract those marriages. Women are still not protected by legal structures. They're very vulnerable to divorce, to poverty. When we look at the legal structure, the spaces of imagining new ways of creating domesticity and partnerships and companionate marriages, we might say that things are changing considerably, but this is largely in urban areas. Mm-hmm. In the countryside, and we have to remind ourselves that Niger is still a country. It is a country where over half of the population is rural, right? It hasn't yet shifted to urbanity in a way that other countries on the African continent have. So there, traditional marriages are still very much part of the picture. But we see that kind of urban-rural divide.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Great. Thanks, Adeline. You know, this, in a way, the way that you were talking about the shift in perhaps even imagining the possibilities that romantic love provides, whether or not it's realized, the possibilities of the romantic love reminds me that, you know, through your book, and particularly in chapters 5 and 6, the last two chapters of the book, you sort of focus your writing on the cultivation of a certain kind of masculinity, which is bodily, you know, embedded in the body and conducted through the body, through various regimes of discipline the body, through various ways in which style and dress is iconed through the body. And if we put this all together, I was wondering if you could offer us a few comments about how do you situate your book, this particular book, but your larger interest that seems to be a part of this book, in youth studies, in the broader framework of the study of generation in Africa. And I'll say a little more about it just to situate my question, which is to say that, you know, generation as an analytic has had a very long and exciting career in the studies of kinship, particularly in Africa, and there are iconic works about that, in ways which we may not be able to imagine today. However, how would you situate something like the Fada, not merely in the broader context of youth studies, which we may, you know, risk saying is a sort of a temporal phase of a broader experience of generation. So how do you situate this work and the larger interest in youth studies in a broader genealogy of the study of generation, the said study of generation as an identity, as an experience in the context of change in various aspects, but also particularly in aspects of friendship and kinship and gender relationships and identities of masculinity, which you are, you know, centering in the Fada.
Of course, as you said, generation and youth have been studied at length by anthropologists and social theorists. Generation is a we might say a typical anthropological topic, something that generations of field workers have explored and written extensively about, how parents raise their children, the whole question of rites of passage, romance, courtship, marriage, the birth of children. Those are all quintessential anthropological topics. Whether we look at it from a generational angle or whether we want to look at it from a kinship or even political angle, you know, across layers, those are very important and traditional issues, which most students read about even in introduction to anthropology courses, right? So as you say, there's nothing typically, there's nothing new about this topic. But I tried in the book not to focus on. There's been a lot of in the past decade, wonderful studies in Africa and elsewhere, but in Africa especially, framing the question of youth as something that was in crisis, the crisis of youth, youth as gangs, youth as violent intruders in the political space, youth as criminals, or alternatively as vulnerable, preyed upon by a patriarchy and a system, a political system that doesn't leave any space for youth, where elders hog resources and power and don't let young people voice their concerns or have any kind of seat at the table of power. So in some sense, I was trying to not use crisis as the kind of register through which to write the book. I was interested in looking instead at creativity, what really was struck me when I started looking at the Fada, which elders typically would criticize as a space of laziness. They would always talk about the young men who don't have jobs, who don't marry because they don't have bride wealth, because they can't afford to have a wife. And it's all because of laziness. And the tea is just kind of a drug, and it makes them complacent, and elders work to feed their children. It's a world turned upside down. And so there was a lot of this kind of criticism. And of course, that's the backdrop against which I chose to sort of center my narrative of the Fada. And when I started really spending time at the Fada and considering, well, what really is happening there? I came across so many instances of creativity, so many ways in which these young men would transcend, try to overturn the narrative of failure that was assigned to them, and that they had plans, they tried to create, they tried to produce, they tried to, it's of course an imaginative project, a way of projecting yourself into the future, imagining a better life for yourself. But that kind of striving, I argue, actually does give them a kind of momentum. And it also gives them a sense of self-assurance. So in some ways, I was trying to complicate a little bit some of that narrative of youth as just revolutionaries who don't want to have the life of their parents and who are simply critiquing their parents, as all youth do, because they're rebelling, because they want things to be different. So while ostensibly there is, yes, it's just another generation that's demanding their rights to exist, to have a place, and to have resources. In other ways, I think something different is happening because, the Fada is a place that certainly replaced, it's a place, it's not just a place, right? It's a physical space, but it's also much more than that. It's a form of sociality, it's a way of living. It's a way of affirming one's existence in a kind of creative, politicized way. It's also a space of just conversation where, oh, I just want to be with my friends. And mm-hmm. this is what we are doing. We're just having fun. We are drinking tea and we don't want to think about our problems. So it's all of that. But I was really interested in both thinking of the Fada as a continuation of the structures that previously existed in Niger to capture and capitalize youthful energies for the benefit of the state. Prior to the Fada, of course, there existed youth structures that were headed by elders, and they channeled the energy of youth towards harvests, certain building projects, as well as political shows when presidential figures, heads of state, various kinds of, you know, figures of power came to town. The youth were corralled and made to dance, to sing, to perform, to do all kinds of things. When democracy emerged in the 1990s, those kinds of structures that were really an instrument of the state disintegrated, and that's when the Fada sort of emerged in their place. So I was really interested in both the way in which the Fada could be seen as, well, a continuation of prior structures, and yet something completely different, a new system that was created by youth for them. And as you mentioned, we have to think about the Fada as a in the context of gender. So the I should have probably said that in response to your previous question, but the Fada being a male space is nevertheless a place where women they're part of the space too. They're less visible. They typically don't show up until late at night, when in fact they can no longer be seen. They hide under the cover of darkness. So the Fada is also the space where love can flourish, where conversations about love amongst young men, conversations about marriage happen. It is also where marriage, the plans, right, the preparations for marriage really take hold in the space of the Fada. Much of the financing for certain events during the wedding are cannot happen without the Fada. I mean, you need your friends to finance part of the celebration. So much of the question of, you know, am I ready to marry? How do I finance my wedding? Who's behind me? All of that happens at the Fada. There's this, so the Fada is a very supportive space for young men to imagine themselves as courting young women. And the courting may actually happen at the Fada itself. But the Fada is also the space where you get the counseling, you get the support, emotional and financial, from your friends. So it's an essential part of social reproduction, even if paradoxically, it is seen as a space that's devoid of women, where women don't really have a place. And if they, young women who spent too much time at the Fada, who talk to young men, who are seen as even sitting amongst them, are you know, run the risk of earning a very bad reputation in the neighborhood. And so it is actually not a good thing for young mm-hmm. women to be seen at the fada. Mm-hmm. So I think we want to see the fada as a space of friendship, as a space of masculinity, where young men are in the absence of other means for them to forge masculinity, manhood, maturity, social maturity, as something that is possible with jobs, with financial independence. The fada then gives young men tools for them to forge a certain kind of masculinity that they can be proud of. And so the various projects they engage in, whether they be sartorial projects, dressing up like a rapper or like a musical star, or whether it be being seen as do-gooders who engage in various kinds of projects for the neighborhood, cleaning up cemeteries and schools, building walls, investing themselves as representatives of the neighborhood for the state, NGOs, all of those various kinds of conversations that they engage in are meant to, on the one hand, sort of enhance the image of the fada for the neighborhood, but also forge a modern masculinity that's predicated on, alternative ways of showing that one can contribute to society in the absence of secure jobs and stable livelihoods. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. In that sense, the fada actually plays a very traditional role of promoting social reproduction.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, Adeline. I mean, that was a wonderful sort of response to the anxieties about what has been called, in various ways, the alleged inversion of the intergenerational contract in so many situations of precarity and, marginalization of the youth that we are witnessing all over. So that's a great way of to think about it in terms of the ways, creative and purposeful ways in which alternative relationships of friendship and kinship may be formed at these sites. My sort of last question for our conversation today is about the visual language of the book. The fact that the book is so beautifully written and there is a very striking visual language. I'm always reminded of this phrase that you use, that is the sitting that kills the pants, and many other such sort of evocative ways of reminding us that the space of the fada and the sensibilities that it conveys to the readers is part of being at the fada. So I wanted to ask you, and in a way of telling our listeners, how many of these writing choices that you had to make, how did they come about? Was it the fact that the sensorium of the fada, the effect that it had in you and the effect that it translates onto the readers? What kind of writing choices did you have to make? If you can point us to any particular instance that you remember of, or was it in some measure the fact that the ethnographic social world that you inhabited and that you're writing about also in some ways rendered itself to the kind of writing that we see in the book? So I'm sure our listeners would, love to know about the kinds of choices that went into the writing of a text on boredom and belonging.
Yes. Oh, that's a lovely expression, visual language. I like that. So I was mainly working with and speaking with Hausa speakers. Mm-hmm. In Niamey, people speak other languages, which I don't speak. So I had to rely on either French. Now, of course, many educated young men speak French. Some don't or speak French poorly due to the fact that schools have become impoverished. Education has suffered dramatically from those drastic economic reforms and the cuts that have been made to the educational system, which I was referring to earlier. In any event, so I spoke primarily in French and in Hausa. Hausa is a lingua franca in Niger. So there are non-native Hausa speakers. They speak Hausa, usually better than me. it's very convenient. Hausa is wonderful as a language. It is, we might say, it is a visual language. Lots of metaphors, lots of proverbs. People knew I like proverbs. I'm always writing down the proverbs. I don't necessarily write down everything else, and I don't necessarily tape conversations either, because I feel that it stifles conversation and I want people to feel free. Certain expressions, certain visual forms of language, I will write up. And then I'll ask everyone else, well, what does that mean? Do you use that expression? And so on and so forth. So the sitting that kills the pent, mm-hmm, is an expression which I referred to at the onset of the book. It seemed while I was writing the introduction that it would be a good way to start. I also presented part of that material earlier on, and I had gotten totally used to the expression. For me, it became normal when I heard it. It didn't make me jump with joy as when I hear something new that's incredibly evocative, right? And you know you've just latched onto, you've just come across something really rich and that needs to be unpacked, and that captures a whole micro world. But hearing my audiences, every time I spoke of the sitting that kills the pen, I realized, oh, that expression packs a punch. It's a really powerful way of speaking of a certain kind of disempowerment. So I decided this would be a good place to start, a good expression to start the conversation with in the introduction. And I've always been interested in dress and clothes, and in fact I think every one of my book has a dress chapter, or if it doesn't, the first book doesn't because I took it out, but maybe I forget now. Anyway, in my dissertation, I had a dress chapter. It was about dressing the spirits during, you know, spirit possession performances. So the sitting that kills the pent, which is literally the fact that when you sit because you have nothing to do, you use up the bottom of your pants where you, right where you sit, becomes used up, becomes frayed, so that when you stand up, people see there are holes in your pants, right where you used to sit. To me, it spoke so powerfully of disempowerment. people who engage in hard labor have work clothes. They don't wear their nice clothes to go harvest their millet or to milk their cows. And for young men to tell me that it wasn't their work activities that got their clothes frayed and used and worn, but it was the absence of activity, I thought was a really important way that really signified what social immobility was. It was both a physical immobility and it was a more existential kind of immobility. And for men who typically walk about, are very visible in the public sphere, whether they are farmers, whether they're pastoralists, whether they're teachers, or doctors, nurses. For young men to tell me, you know, my clothes are used up because I sit around because I have nothing to do, because I don't have a job, because I'm poor, seemed, you know, incredibly important. So that's what made me want to, you know, front load that image that people would mm-hmm. have that in their mind as they read mm-hmm. the book. But yes, it was something that I've always been interested in, language, the way people phrase certain modes of being, experiences. There's another one in chapter 7, which I also use. It's a proverb, and it's about the fact that when you're running after a in Nigeria, you have those little mini, they're not tornadoes. People identify them as tornadoes, but they're not tornadoes. They're just little twirling masses of air that move about. They don't destroy anything. They're not destructive. But they move about, and just like a tornado, you don't know if a tornado is going to turn right or left. It moves about across the landscape. So the proverb I use that sort of to provide a mood for chapter 7, which is about political engagement, mm-hmm. and the fact that young men may belong to one party and then shift over to another party because it's convenient, because there are opportunities, and then they'll shift again to the previous party they were a member of because another opportunity has arisen. I felt that this particular mode of zigzagging, which I call political zigzagging, was aptly captured by that proverb of, you know, there's no rest for the man who pursues the whirlwind. Mm-hmm. And that's a typical Hausa proverb. Mm-hmm. And I was really struggling when I wrote the book. How can I talk about the fact that young men ostensibly just sit around and do nothing? They drink tea all day. And yet, in fact, they're engaged in multiple ways, multiple modes of earning an income. They have all these different possibilities. They start all these different projects, knowing that half of them are not going to pan out. Half of them are just going to fizzle. And so there has to be in play of a host of possible means of earning income, however minimal it might be, just so that, you know, you can survive. And so this kind of constant instability, you're sitting, but you're always ready for the next opportunity, constant on this mode of alertness, watchful for what comes across the landscape that you can, you know, that opportunity you can grab. And mm-hmm. so I structured the entire book starting with immobility as a mode of being, as an existential problem, and then ending with that kind of restlessness of the man who pursues the whirlwind and who has no rest, based on conversations, testimonies I had with young men who told me how exhausting things were. And I was exhausted for them, and I was exhausted with them, because, you know, it's that moment when you're during field work, you're going with one of your friends, right? And he's supposed to sit with you at some point, and you're supposed to talk about stuff, and you have this whole set of questions for him. And then he goes, oh, well, okay, since we are in a car, why don't we go here? I have to pick up this. And, oh, I need to go to this guy's house. He promised me he may have a job for me for a couple of weeks. And I need to talk to my aunt because she's going to give me some chickens. I'm going to start a chicken farm. And, you know, and then the whole morning is gone. And all you've done is run around with him, sort of enabling him to meet all his contacts and start all these different little mini projects. And you're thinking, my God, you know, I'm not doing field work. I'm just following this guy running around. But at some point you realize, no, this is the field work. I don't need to ask questions. He's taught me that this is his life. He's not sitting around. Well, sometimes he is, but sometimes he's running around. And so once I figured that out, once I had that epiphany, it really, it was a matter of thinking about how do I structure this book, starting with, you know, the tea drinking, the boredom, the guys who are just sitting by the side of the street being insulted by elders who don't greet them because they see them as being parasites. And then at the end of the book, you know, that sort of restlessness, this constant anxiety, you know, young men who say, oh, I don't even have time to sleep anymore because I'm always doing stuff. And so the chapters, I was trying to sort of structure them around that kind of tension, right? Which I think is not specific to Niger. I mean, the whole way in which the emerging generation, the millennials, are also, many of them have very precarious employment and are having to, whether it's in the US, in Niger, in France, in Mexico, in Japan, they don't have stable employment. So they're constantly having to look for jobs, even as they're doing the jobs. And so the distinction between work and leisure completely fizzles. Their whole existence becomes this sort of diffuse form of work that that brings about terrifying anxiety. There's no rest. You're constantly having to scheme and project yourself in the future, looking for new forms of employment, looking to somehow create a more secure foothold in the job market. So in some ways, I think the kind of situation I described as specific to Nigerian youth really speak to a wider problematic that we see unfolding across the world, both in the global South and in the global North. But what's of course wonderful about Niger is that the language with which people speak, both of love, of pleasure, of happiness, of even the simple pleasures of drinking tea, tea becomes they told me that, you know, tea is a drug, tea is a virus that you catch on and then you're contaminated. All of these forms of being, whether it's the simple pleasures of life, whether it's the existential angst of the perpetually precariously employed youth, whether it's the imaginings of prosperity and social success and mature adulthood that they hope will eventually, be part of their experience. All of those modes of being, they often described in highly evocative language. And so despite the fact that I will never speak Hausa as a native, I still managed to catch on all these wonderful forms of visual language. And of course, one part of that visual language, which I can perhaps speak of briefly, if there's still time, are the names they give to their fadas. When you drive across or walk across urban centers, you cannot but be astonished by the visual culture. Young men have literally taken over the walls of the towns. And I don't mean, of course, public walls such as, the presidential palace or the courts or administrative offices or fancy grocery stores, but in the more modest neighborhoods, they have taken over the walls, mud walls or concrete walls. Usually they're the public face of the walls that surround courtyards and homes. And this is where they plaster their visual imaginings of the fada, right? So they give names to their fadas, they write the name of the fada in big, bold letters, and they imagine a whole set of visual icons that is incredibly, it tells you so much about what they're dreaming about. They dream of becoming famous rap stars. They dream of becoming strong and bulky and you know, elegantly dressed or modern, fancy English speakers. So there's a lot wrapped up in those you know, iconic visual representations of the fada. But I devote a whole chapter to that because I felt it was essential to understanding the fada as a not just as a place where you drink tea, not just as a place where you plan your wedding or you court your girlfriend, not just as a place where you show up dressed up, as a musical star, but also as an aesthetic space that, as far as young men are concerned, beautifies the neighborhood. They're very clear that they're not. Even though some of those images, those murals, look like tagging and graffiti, and in some ways they share a lot of the characteristics of graffiti, young men insist, no, we are beautifying the neighborhood. This is our contribution to urban space, to urban culture.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And that is, I will say it again, that the visual language of the book is so compellingly able to convey all of that stuff that you just spoke about. And I know we have taken up a lot of your time, but before we let you go, I would love for our listeners to know what is the next thing you're working on and what is it that we can expect to see from you next?
So I've for my next book, I've returned to my earlier doctoral research, picked up on my interest in spirit possession. At some point, I became aware that schoolgirls were being possessed by spirits in schools. And it wasn't just an individual thing. Sometimes it was. But more often than not, the kind of possession that one girl would suddenly exhibit was contagious. In a matter of moment, half the classroom was possessed. And this happened not just in Dogondutchi. It happened everywhere, in Niamey, in other cities across the country. So it wasn't specific to a region or an ethnicity. It happened even in Islamic schools, or at least it did so in Dogondutchi, the town where I've been, you know, spending much of my time in the past 30 years while doing research. And what's fascinating about those incidents, which of course tend to wreak havoc, right? Schools have to be closed. Parents tend to be very wary about sending their daughters back to school. I'm looking at it as, on the one hand, a commentary on the state of affairs, a state of affairs having to do with the controversy surrounding teenage girls' education in a country that has, where certain conservative Muslim quarters, there's a resistance to girls' education. It's fine for primary school, but as soon as puberty hits, many religious leaders insist that school is not the proper place for girls. They should be married. Their purity should be preserved. Schools are described as dens of vice, and schoolgirls sometimes earn a bad reputation. So there are questions of modesty, purity, respectability attached to young girls of marriageable age, which the school environment tends to sully, tends to destroy. So the government's trying to pass laws to protect the right of girls to attend school until 18, but this is a very controversial issue. So girls are caught up in that particular kind of public discourse. And on the other hand, there's a whole other dimension to the possession experience having to do with the fact that the girls who are possessed, when speaking with the voice of the spirit, speak of the fact that schools were built on spaces previously occupied by spirits. So trees were cut, schools were built. What we can see is that urbanization, growing demography, the expansion of education in Niger post-independence, all of those different modes of what we might call development, had an impact on the ecology of spaces. Of course, farmers complain there's no more land, that there's drought, you know, so we can talk about ecology, we can talk about environment, we can talk about Islamic iconoclasm, a lot of spirit-based practices that were essential to the viability of communities, the health of families and land, fields, animals. Much of that has been set aside as people massively converted to Islam in the post-independence era. Niger earned its independence in 1960. So it's a very complicated narrative that involves questions of memory, questions of a past that resurfaces in the guise of angry spirits demanding their dues, demanding that the grievances they have be heard. The trees that they used to inhabit were cut to make space for schools. So that intersects with the whole discourse about girls' right to education. So there's a very rich narrative around those spirit possession events. We can look, of course, at each and every girl's own individual experience and their struggles with adolescence, with love, with boyfriends, their anxieties about marriage. But there's also a larger narrative that they become part of by being possessed, since all of them, well, perhaps not all, but many of them, typically once possessed, unleash this narrative of ecological destruction, of Islamic iconoclasm, of a past that refuses to be forgotten. And so I find it totally fascinating that young girls who are not even born when their parents or grandparents became committed Muslims are now speaking of this unsettled past in a way that's really harmful to them, because often enough they miss school, they become sick. In some cases, they don't return to school after being possessed. And of course, the school administration, they don't really want to deal with the religious aspect of those incidents. They talk about biomedical conditions, epilepsy or some kind of female problem, right? And they recommend that parents send their children to the hospital. That doesn't really help in most cases. So I'm really interested in untangling all these different complex narratives that seem to emerge in the classroom, in the school courtyard. And as I said, it's not just one place, it's happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Adeline. That sounds like a very, very interesting project, and all the best for pursuing that as you proceed. I really want to express my gratitude to you for being on the show today. This was a really, really enjoyable and useful conversation. I really enjoyed myself, and I hope so did you. So thank you so much.
I did. Thank you. Thank you, Bhumika. I enjoyed talking about my work, and I certainly enjoyed talking with you. And I hope we meet at some point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Adeline. You take care.
Thank you.